Okay, recording is started. Hi, Andy.
Hey Shannon, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I am great, thank you.
Should we start off by introducing ourselves?
Sure.
I can go first.
Okay.
My name is Shannon Finnegan, and I am an artist. And I have a disability that affects kind of like my movement and walking. And I think relevant to what we'll be talking about is I've been doing a collaborative project with another artist, Bojana Kokliot, for about the past 3 years, called Alt Text as Poetry. That's about describing images.
And I'm Andy Slater, and I'm also an artist, and I am blind. And I wrote this piece for McSweeney's audio issue that we are going to touch upon today. I use a lot of accessibility, not only for blind and visually impaired people in my work, but also people who are deaf, a hard hearing, or people with sensory needs and concerns and all of that sort of thing. So it's a big part of my work in general. So this whole piece here is kind of a good summary of that.
Yeah, same. I feel like that's something that we have in common is making work that is both related to our own access needs, but also thinking about cross disability solidarity and yeah, thinking about also creating different access points for other disabled people.
Because if we're not doing it for everybody, who are we doing it for?
Truly. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the piece and how it kind of came about?
Yes. So I've been working on this research for a few years now. The piece that I wrote is basically it's about a researcher in the late 60s who was at Duke University named Dr. Janet Herman, and she worked with a number of blind people and participants in some studies there at their ocular corrective lab, kind of working with blind people collecting data and their kind of archiving their experiences with everyday life and all this other kind of stuff. And she had this theory that blind people can hear transdimensionally, right? She was studying Charles Bonnet syndrome while at the OCL, and that's something where blind people they hallucinate. They can't see, but they hallucinate things there, like people or floating hats and I don't know, fabulous weddings and that sort of thing. It's something that Oliver Sacks has done a lot of writing about. And so during that time, she said some of the people there were talking about how they also, had these sort of oral hallucinations that were not at all connected to Charles Bonnet syndrome. And the people at OCL didn't believe her, so she kind of went out on her own research and conducted this study. And she interviewed a bunch of participants from all over the country, different ages, different backgrounds, etc. And kind of came to this conclusion that blind people can hear transdimensionally. They can hear things that are, I guess, in a parallel universe or happening somewhere else, these sort of events, these people, these things, these sounds that nobody else could hear but themselves. And so she titled this, her theory was cryptoacoustic auditory non-hallucination. And it's kind of a long title, but I love it. And so anyway, she went and did all this research, and then Duke was like, cut her funding. It was like, we're not going to fund this new age woo-woo. You got to cut it out and go back to what you were doing. And so she said, forget it. She closed up her lab and went back to her practice, because her private practice, because she felt disrespected and they wouldn't listen to her and all that sort of thing. So I found out about this researching, like, science fiction and historical tropes of blindness, because I was doing some absurd sound piece where I wanted, like, these quotes from, like, blind space mages and samurais and stuff from, like, movies and stuff, to do this, ridiculous sound installation. But I found out about this study while I was, like, just researching that stuff through some message boards or whatever they're called these days. And and then so I thought it was a rumor. I thought it was just, a lie, or a hoax or something like that. And then somebody had posted about how her brother was involved in this, and how her brother was blind, told his parents that, he was hearing stuff too, and they didn't want him to be doubly disabled, so they never did anything about it. They didn't want to admit that their son might be hearing stuff while he can't see anything. And I kind of had, like, very similar sort of things happen when I was a kid. I didn't even tell my parents, though, so I intervened on my own. So, long story short, I started researching this after running into some, roadblocks here and there. I finally got an email from this IT dude, to tell me more about this, because apparently the doctor had recorded these conversations and attempted to record the sounds. So she'd sit down in a in her custom made studio with her custom made microphones that she called transitory sound catchers, and would interview these folks and attempted to record these sounds, thinking that somehow she'd be able to reach another dimension and record it. The IT dude found these tapes and digitized them for me, and it's like I was excited, because I thought I was going to be hearing these amazing sounds and everything. When I got the tapes, when I got the AIFF files from this dude, it was just the doctor's voice and kind of introducing the sounds, and then none of the sounds. So she would be setting it up, naming the participant, describing, recalling what they said they were hearing, and then there's just a bunch of, blank tape hiss and everything like that. Which, itself is like, well, I can't hear the sounds, but apparently I know what they sounded like. So I started taking this stuff and cutting it up and turning it into some kind of ridiculous sound thing, and was just really interested in, like, I'm really interested in all this archival stuff, right? Found stuff, anything to do with blindness, especially from that era. Especially, like, the technology and stuff. And then during my, like, restoration of the sound and cleanup, I unlocked these sounds, right? So, like, some phase inversion and some transmogrification and things like that. There they were, like, there were the sounds that these people announced, like the girls listening to music that sounded like an electric abacus and speaking some unknown language, and the electric snakes and all this other stuff that's in there. And so basically, the piece of McSweeney's has, I think it's like 15 minutes, excerpts of this audio with the doctor introducing the sounds, and then, portions of the sounds laid out in succession, along with, like, a dossier of other, like, artifacts and ephemera and stuff from that were found when they cracked open her office. And yeah, and then you were asked to collaborate by doing sound descriptions of the sounds that were already described. So it's this awesome, absurd game of stoner telephone.
And I think maybe one thing I'll say is that part of the issue, the McSweeney's issue that your piece is in, it's called the audio issue, and part of my understanding of the issue as a whole is thinking about access and kind of the inaccessibility of print only media. And part of that process, they also wanted to produce a descriptive transcript for the issue. And so I think that was part of why I was brought in to do sound descriptions, and also image descriptions for the visual materials associated with the piece. And yeah, it was really hard and really interesting. I think especially because, yeah, there are these participant descriptions that, as I was listening to the audio, really shaped my experience of it. Like that, when one of the participants talks about, like a sound of dancing, or I think was one of them, or things like that. It kind of shapes how I heard it. And so then thinking about how to, how to describe the sounds in a way that was kind of like felt related to that or related to my experience of it. I'll also say, like, I'm not someone who works in sound very much, so I don't have a broad sound vocabulary. And a lot of times when I'm describing things, I rely on metaphor. And but in this case, like, there kind of already is a set of metaphors associated with each piece of sound from the participants because they're interpreting what they're hearing often through kind of metaphor. And so that was kind of interesting for me to try to, kind of pull away from metaphor and think more about kind of trying to describe like the textures of the sound or,
And that's really, I think that we have a very, at least in the English language, we have a very, vast vocabulary to describe things visually, describe images and things like that. But for sound, it's not as abundant, and it's all metaphorical. Like honestly, it's really hard to for me not to describe things sometimes in terms of like comic book, like where you hear, you see like somebody gets punched in the face and it goes thwack, like that kind of stuff. And I use that kind of like onomatopoetic sort of approach to stuff. Because since I started working on this, I did a in the cryptoacoustic auditory non-hallucination, I did a presentation at the Chicago Disability Cultures and Studies Conference in 2018 at the University of Illinois Chicago, and I talked about this and presented some of my research there. And like kind of since that time, a lot of the sound work that I've been doing, I've written this sound descriptive alternative text to a lot of my work because I want it to be accessible, even if it's just like in a subjective way for whoever can't hear it or chooses not to listen, doesn't want to hear it, and so, like this whole thing is like, oh wow, this is really a great I don't know, point of access, whether or not, it's like this, verbatim description of it or not. It's just kind of like, if you can't, if you're unable to hear, do you get all of these references, So when it comes to like describing the one dance piece is like the quote is a dance recital, a wooden stage. I am convinced that this person is dancing on their hands. Like that's what the quote was. And so it definitely sounds like somebody's clogging, but if they're doing it on their hands or on the ceiling or whatever the hell it is, it's that description's already there. And then so you had to take over the responsibility of like sound by sound, the qualities of those sounds. And so, needless to say, I think that if you don't, if you're not a sound person, you probably still have a similar, vocabulary to, kind of, define, audible things,
Totally, and that's something that in my work with Bojana about image description, I think a lot of times people feel hesitant to describe, for example, art objects or artworks if they're not artists or curators or kind of in that world. But I often find, that kind of like non-expertise can also be really valuable in description. Like it can sometimes be more direct or kind of when you're not an expert, like you don't get as caught up in like being right or something. You can just kind of get a little weirder with the language as you're kind of trying to feel through it. But I also wanted to say I thought something that you were interested in that you were saying about so much of sound description being metaphor. I was just thinking about the way for me sound is often so connected to mood and feeling. And I often feel like that's what's missing from image descriptions, is that it's like too much about what is happening in the image and not enough about how it's happening or how that makes a person who's looking at it feel. And so, yeah, I was just thinking about those kinds of, and just that I feel like metaphor often helps in terms of kind of getting to feeling or mood or kind of tone.
Yeah, and a friend of mine who's a photographer was describing her work to me as ambient photography. And I've never heard that. What is that? And it's basically like photos of, a lot of her stuff is like photos of abandoned buildings, especially like industrial or educational or even like hospital institutions sort of thing, where it's a photo of a space. And I guess through that photo, you get an idea of how run down and neglected the place is, what it may have looked like, and all that sort of thing. And I hadn't even heard of that, where, like ambient sound and music and all that sort of thing is, certainly, and ambient lighting, I guess, is another thing people talk about that I didn't really have much of a relationship with. But it's like, I thought it was interesting because then I started thinking about it as like a mood, because, sound affects me physically. Like there's certain, sounds that kind of have an effect on my body. And I know that a lot of people kind of, some people experience that with like ASMR or whatever that stuff is. And I don't think it's at all similar to, how I perceive sounds. Since I'm blind, I use sound for everything, like navigation, safety, making coffee, crossing the street, that kind of stuff. Being able to hear people whispering from like 20,000 feet away. And so, it's kind of interesting to hear visual art, described in that way. I love it because it's like when so I'm a consumer of image descriptions, I guess you could say. I'm somebody that relies on that stuff. And so if somebody was to tell me that it was an ambient painting, I'd be like, well, you need now to tell me what exactly that is. And those are kind of the struggles that I came up with when I'm trying to describe those kind of sounds, in my own work. It's like, well, how the hell do you describe the sound of a big empty room that just has like, some kind of machinery in it that's really quiet? It's like, how do you do this? And so you have to use metaphor. I think that it's the only real way to do it, and I think it works best when it's totally subjective and coming from the point of view of the person describing it. If you said, oh, it's a picture of a brick building, okay, cool. If there's nothing stunning or interesting about it, you could just leave it there. I see so many people go way overboard with describing something so mundane, and it's like, oh my God. And then if I'm online and I'm scrolling through with my screen reader and there's, photos, and a lot of the times Getty will have alt text like tag on their things. So it'll say, President Obama in the Rose Garden. All right, cool. If he's wearing a dope suit, tell me about the suit. Otherwise, pass on, and so those kind of descriptions are sometimes very, very nice to hear, as opposed to, this elongated sort of like, a docent telling me the history of this piece and that sort of thing, where it's like, I want to give up.
Well, and I think it's something that I've noticed. Well, yeah, and I'm curious to know your thoughts about this. I feel like sometimes the focus on describing visual information kind of like makes it seem like the visual stuff is really important. Like it ends up kind of like putting this like, I don't know, kind of like emphasis on it. Whereas like what you're saying, that kind of short description can give you the context and then you can get to text or other or sound or other parts of the experience that that you might be interested
And it comes down to when you're in a Zoom meeting and people are doing like access checks and describing themselves, and Everybody takes like 3 minutes to talk about what they're wearing and that sort of thing. And if there's like 50 people in the meeting, I understand and totally appreciate that this might be is being done for my benefit, you know? And it's really sometimes it takes up a lot of time, and I'm a very impatient blind person. But it is also very interesting if, you know, start to study what people start off with, where they often start off with gender, skin color, maybe what they're wearing, maybe their age, and then like what's behind them. And like, oh, and then there's a photograph, you know, or there's an abstract painting in the back. Like, you know, you should have led with that and told me all about that, you know? Because sometimes people will give you information that doesn't help at all, where someone's like, you know, I am a cishet white woman, and like that. So, you know, what does that have to do with what, you know, describing how you look visually, you know, it's, I don't know. This is just something where I can go on and on about where it totally isn't crucial to this conversation.
No, I think
But
it is. I mean, I think also what you're bringing up, I think, is that like blind people also want really different things. Like I know from collaborating with Bojana, like she lives with low vision and she often mentions her own fashion and often responds. Like that's a big part of like what she, it seems like that's something that she really enjoys in those interactions and but that's also not for everyone. And I think this like kind of presumption that there's one way that we do this, or we always do this, or we always do it in this way, just doesn't make sense because it should be about relationships and being responsive to what people actually want or need.
exactly. And I love it when people, you know, I was in a meeting the other day where someone was like describing the head wrap that they were wearing. Like, oh, well, that's, I want to hear more about that. And then the next person was like, I have on a t-shirt with this band logo. And it's really hard to read because it's a black metal band. So the logo actually just kind of looks like a, you know, a thorn bush. I'm like, oh my God, that's actually pretty awesome. But, you know, but, and you know, that's totally cool. And I really, I like knowing about fashion because I also feel like that's something that people don't really think that blind people care about. But if you saw me out in the town, you would know that I do. So, but yeah, you know, it's pick and choose, and there's a right time and a wrong time to go overboard with stuff, you know. And and right now we're just talking about like Zoom meetings. Now, if it's a photograph on Instagram, then lay it on me however you want. I got time, you know. If I need to, I have time. And you know, I'm totally into it. Especially, you know, it's like I have friends who are fashion designers, and it's, you know, the ones that do image descriptions do a wonderful job. You know, some straightforward about the fit, color, and then, you know, the model. And a lot of times I think that they ask, you know, they ask the model how they wish to be described, you know, which I think is real important. And you know, and then sometimes there's just this like sassy comment, which I love too, because fashion people to me, you know, in my experience, often come with detail and data and then sass, and that's just a wonderful combination.
Yeah, as you were talking, and also talking about self-description in Zooms, I was thinking about how, like, I feel like a lot of times descriptions are just boring. Like, I feel like that's, and like, what you were saying about, like, kind of like, okay, if the suit is cool, tell me about it. You know, like, it's like, sometimes that's something I think about when I'm writing an image description is like, what's interesting here? Or like, if this isn't an interesting image, I mean, A, kind of like, why am I even sharing it? But like, yeah, kind of what's exciting here to me, and then how can I convey that interest and excitement or whatever feeling it's associated with it in the description. And yeah, and just like not have it be boring. I feel like that is often my goal.
It absolutely. And a lot of the times it just comes down to who is describing it. Like, do you describe the describer? You know, a lot of, you know, different communities and cultures describe stuff differently. They get from point A to point B differently, you know, and like I never want to lose that. I don't want anybody to think that they have this standard, like, Western waspy way of having to do this sort of stuff, you know? And so when you think socially about, you know, the trends on how certain cultures describe stuff, it's really interesting, you know. And I like, you know, when different people describe the same thing, like on You Describe, things you describe.org, where, you know, it's like community created audio description for videos that are found on YouTube. And it's like you get like Fashion Week, you know, the same video for like Fashion Week or something that's done by somebody that knows all the designers and knows everything about the fit and the cut and what's trendy or not. And then you have like, you know, maybe a young girl who's describing this for her blind cousin. We're like, Jenny, all right, the pause the video. All right, Jenny, this dude's lapel, like this collar, you might just fly away. It's like he's from 70, 1972 or something like that. And that's, to me, it's like, oh man, this is beautiful because it's personal and personable and that kind of thing, you know? And then when you get kids describing stuff, it's so much, oh, it's just fun. And it just reminds you that, like, oh God, the way that we perceive stuff is totally like, you know, tainted and dismembered when we're kids. You know, we're taught how to do things the right way and how to communicate in, like, you know, not so abstract or colorful ways. There was a piece that Tommy Carroll, who's another blind person that I collaborate with, that we did at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago for Family Day. And we had all these kids. We would project something from the MCA's permanent collection, and they would describe it to Tommy and I. And you'd have like maybe two kids describe the same image, and then a parent. And the parent would be like, "It's a cloud in the sky." And then another kid was like, "Be like, it's a golden cloud, but it looks like it may have been originally silver, but after it was put through some long tube where it squished it out and changed the color, and now it's flying." And then the next kid would be like, "It actually looks like something else." And it's just like amazing, you know? It's like, this, just keep going, kids. Tell your parents to sit down. And anyway, we took like the prompts, some of the descriptions, and then you know, the kids would get up on the stage and we gave them a bunch of stuff to bang on, and we would kind of do this spontaneous, like, you know, performance, like rhythmic performance based on the prompt. So it would be like, all right, now we're turning gold, and then they'd do something different, which I don't know if they even knew it. They were just new to change. And so it's just like, when you take the way that kids describe stuff, man, it's like, I don't know, it's just inspiring to go and do something different. And so with the stuff that Dr. Herman recorded, you know, there's people there that are like, there's bios for every participant from that day, that session, that recording session. There's some people that are senior citizens, some that are middle-aged, some that are in their 20s, and then some that are teenagers. And they kind of take different approaches on how they describe stuff. Some people are grumpy, some people are matter of fact, and then some people are, you know, just really out there. And the kids are actually, you know, I feel are more to the point, because it seems like these imaginative sounds are just kind of part of their lives because they're kids. So it's just kind of like, you know, I feel like they were conveying this, like, this sounds like an electric eel, it's an electric eel that they have down south. But it's not in the water because I'm afraid of water, so I wouldn't be near it or something like that. You know, they're like, oh, my proximity to this, I don't like water, so I'm not going to ever be near water. So I don't think that this sound is coming from somebody in, you know, some kind of water world. I have no idea. I would love to know more about what any of that stuff had to do with anything, but it is really brilliant. And you're just kind of like, okay. And then the sound is like this thing that goes, you know, that kind of sounds like an electric snake. I don't know. I don't know.
I think what you're saying about this idea, I mean, something that Bojan and I have run into over and over again when thinking about image description is just this there's been this kind of traditional standard of quote unquote objectivity, which, as you were saying, like just doesn't really, like, A, I think it often produces kind of boring descriptions. B, like, what is objectivity? Like, we're all experiencing things so differently, and this idea that there's a kind of universal or mainstream experience of a sound or an image just like makes no sense to me and feels like kind of what you were saying just ends up, yeah, like when people say kind of objective, really what they mean is kind of like mainstream or,
Standard.
yeah, white, like
Yeah.
male, like, you know, all middle class, all of those things instead of actually being something that could be objectivity. And I mean, I think that's something that's been really exciting to me about description on social media is because that is so much about social experiences that, like, I think people do often feel more comfortable kind of stepping into their own voice a little bit and getting a little bit more flexible about the descriptions. And I've noticed this for me also, like, I feel that way more on Instagram and then even on my own portfolio website. Like, for some reason, I've felt the need to, like, button up my descriptions a little bit more. And recently I was like, why did I do that? Like, that's not better. I should just use the same descriptions from Instagram. Like, those ones are, I think, a better experience of the images.
Well, and it's what's really great about Instagram is that you have two places to include your image description. So one, you could put in the caption where people usually write, in that field. And then you can also, if you go into advanced settings and you can add it into, you can add alternative text. So if somebody's using a screen reader, which is the technology that majority of everybody's devices has native now, it speaks content on the screen of your computer or your phone or whatever, in case somebody isn't familiar with that. When you swipe, when I swipe over onto an image and the voiceover on my iPhone is the cursor is on that image, then it will automatically read me that content, and that text itself is like invisible to sighted people. And so you can have like an image description in your in your caption content, and then you can also have either the same one or a different one that's hidden. And I always like I like to call it invisible ink, where I have a different thing written in as the alt text, where it's if you have a screen reader, then you get it, then you get the inside joke, where it's like, here's a photo of my dinner, spaghetti and meatballs, blah 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 blah. But then in the alt text, say, yeah, the meal was really good, but today is Janet Jackson's birthday. I love Janet Jackson, like that sort of thing. So you can hide this stuff in there too. And that's what I think is really fun about Instagram. And I think you can do that in Facebook. But then in like TikTok, you have character count. So if you are going to be doing that, you have to put it in the same thing that you do all your hashtags and stuff like that. There's no alternative text. There's no like invisible ink text opportunities there or anything. So then you have like a character count of like how much you can put in there. So now you're kind of compromising, maybe not compromising, but you're giving yourself limitations on what you can describe. So that, a lot of the times people either like just blow it off, or like, this image isn't important, I'm wearing a hat. Or people will just, like try to cram as much as they can. And so, limitations are good things, having options, that's cool. I just wish that more people got into the practice of doing so. There's a lot of blind people that don't do it. I'm in like some blind support Facebook groups, and the people who are totally blind, people with all kinds of different levels of vision, and there are some people that they don't need to use a cane, and they have low vision, but they're able to see on their computer, et cetera. And they'll post an image without any kind of description, and it's like, hey, congratulate me, I just won this award. And I'm just always like, image description or it doesn't exist, or just kind of like, I'm gonna be a jerk about it because I'm sick of this not being part of our culture, whereas like captions are part of deaf culture, and so
Yeah, I think there
Kind
have
of
been, well,
politics to this crap.
yeah, totally. And I think, yeah, I mean, especially with social media, it's like every person who's uploading images to those platforms has to add alt text or image descriptions in order to make those platforms accessible. Like, there's really is this like broad need for this practice. But then also what you're saying, I've made me think of, I've heard some interesting conversations recently about just like the accessibility of writing image descriptions that I also think is really interesting in terms of like kind of like, yeah, cross disability solidarity or like ha the kind of messiness of like, yeah, building or being part of these communities and people who are like chronic illness, for example, who like on a high pain day are like writing an image description is really doesn't feel accessible in this moment. And I've seen some kind of cool practices with people like asking for help, kind of being like, hey, I'm not feeling good right now. Like, could somebody put an image description? Could somebody else write the description? Or kind of this like more collaborative thing. And like, yeah, those things are also always really interesting to me in terms of thinking about this kind of, yeah, more like shared or collaborative approach or like how it can be, well, and again, kind of going back to this idea of like there isn't one way to do this that everyone has to do. Like we can all kind of like build this practice in a way that works for our own body minds.
And you know what? I really do appreciate that when people are like, I wanted to put this photo up. It's timely. I'm going to get to the image description because, you know, right now I don't want to do like, you know, voice to text dictation over and over and over again because it keeps screwing up. You know, I don't have the energy to type this. I don't, you know, I just don't have the capacity to do the way that I want to. So if they, you know, if they say like posting this image description forthcoming, I totally appreciate that. And then a lot of the times people will just like drop in a description of it anyway. And you know, it's like on Instagram, I'll always add an image description. On Facebook, sometimes I'll just put it up and be like, I don't know what's happening. Can someone describe this? And people will, because if it's like, a lot of the times I'm like, I don't know what this is. Give me a heads up. And or it's like, I do my best to describe what it is that I know is there. And a lot of the times I'll take a photo of something and like even like, I don't know, like I'll take a picture of my dog, but first I'll pet my dog's face to see if I can tell like what their expression is or that kind of thing. So yeah, there's a lot of planning that goes into it and a lot of attention, but it's not necessarily any more than anything else. It really, you know, a lot of people think that it's a burden to have to do this. And a lot of time is just because there's intimidation of, you know, what if I do it wrong? And it's like, well, it's your photo. You know? I mean, you know, like image, you know, image screen recognition stuff, at least, you know, in Apple, it'll read the text of like a Twitter screenshot or a meme and that sort of thing. Sometimes it'll say, contains this image contains food. You know, and it's like, okay, that's cool. At least I know somebody ate. You know what I mean? And then even in Facebook, you can go in and get like even, you know, more descriptive or, you know, extended descriptions that the AI will try to tell you what it is. So, you know, we can rely on that or we can just very briefly, you know, do our best. And it's like, if you want to communicate with me, then that's cool. If you're a member of the blind community and you don't want to communicate like that, then I will very harshly call you a sellout. But you know, that said, there's just so many different ways to, you know, make, first off, if you're an artist, to make your art, you know, accessible to, you know, disabled folks, deaf and disabled folks. And you know, and then like we were saying, like in your own personal life, yeah, you know, you can just do it. You can turn on like automatic captioning on stuff, you know, but you know, whether that's reliable or not, I wouldn't know, but at least there's that option.
Yeah, and I feel like this is something, this is kind of like a tension that I often feel comes up when I'm talking to people about access which is like both this sense that I have of like something is better than nothing and like start where you are and like do what you can and also and like right, don't get so wrapped up in doing it wrong that you don't do anything, but then also being like, but yes, like this is a practice and something that you're going to be continuing to learn about for the rest of your life. And like, that's also, you're not just going to like do it once and then have it figured out and, you know, be done. And I often find it's like a little bit hard to like navigate that with people in terms of this, like, yeah, like come on in, like let's get going, but also like you know, don't stop there, like keep going and keep learning and keep kind of, I mean, I think of like writing descriptions as a type of artistic practice in and of itself and a type of kind of craft or creative writing practice, and like other forms of writing or creating, like it takes it, you know, you can practice it, you can try out different things and experiment and be like, oh, I tried that and that kind of flopped, or I, you know, want to do it this way this time, or yeah.
Yeah, just consider it experimental and let's experiment with it. And that's kind of like the, you know, and that, and that's, you know, that's something that you all teach in the Alt Texas poetry workshops too, right?
Yeah, experimental approach is a, I has felt like an important way of kind of pushing back against that kind of normative way of describing, of being like, yeah, like let's get a little looser, let's like, you know, and not, yeah, and lots of experiments might not work, but like let's, yeah, let's try it out, let's see what happens.
Have fun with
Yeah, exactly. I
it.
mean, one thing I feel like I want to say before we wrap up is also just that, like, when it comes to like image descriptions or alt text, like blind people and blind culture should be at the center of that kind of like practice, and I do sometimes, I'm sighted and I engage with other sighted people who I feel like they kind of take it and run in their own like kind of sighted direction with it, and I think that's something that I've been thinking about also a lot recently is like also just not putting so much of our energy into making describing visual things, but also putting more energy into making non-visual things and also like supporting blind artists and creators in making whatever they
Yeah,
want to make.
right. That yes. Like if, you know, if you have an initiative to describe your entire archive of things, or you know, or your museum and stuff, you're gonna need to call on a lot of people. But it's also like, you know, don't stop at just making somebody else's art accessible for us. You know, help us make accessible art with, you know, support or funding or just acknowledgement that there's blind artists, you know, and we don't all try to, you know, take photographs. There's some of us that aren't, you know, we don't care about making art for, you know, a sighted audience. You know, it's just kind of like whatever. If I use visual imagery or anything like that in any of my art, I mean, I kind of half jokingly say I'm making it accessible for sighted people, because if I took a sound piece and I sat, you know, sat you down, you don't have nothing to look at, so you know you can't immerse yourself. But if I give you something to look at, even if it's the iTunes visualizer, you'll probably pay more attention to it, you know, than if it's, you know, yeah. So, you know, like, because there's just this history of like, you know, well-to-do or, you know, well-meaning philanthropists putting together you know, an art show in like the lobby of a fancy bank. And but if you want to submit, you have to, you know, you have to send a photo or a painting. And so you're continuing to force blind people to only think that art is for sighted people. And so, you know, I mean, that's, you know, we got to get them into the museums and galleries, you know, get people in there so they feel comfortable, and then just show them like, why is this important? Why the hell should I care that I'm here? And, you know, least, you know, give some options. Have some more sound bass or tactile work in there, or just even more, you know, blind and disabled artists and stuff like that being represented. And then, you know, it's like, you know, a blind person is not going to have the same exact lived experience as, you know, a deaf person or somebody who's like physically disabled or whatever. But we have a very common experience with ableism, and then just adapting our own lives to kind of get by because society's ableist and that sort of thing. And so we may not know exactly everything that's going on from, you know, a shared experience, but we get it. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? So it's like, you know, oh yeah, there's reference, there's understanding for all of this sort of thing. So that's my commentary to galleries and art institutes. Yeah. Art institutions.
Yeah, and I think it's ultimately about like a redistribution or like change of power, like that there's been this like tradition of being like, okay, we have all this like non-disabled artwork and we're gonna like grant disabled people access to it, instead of being like, right. Okay, actually, like, right, disabled people can be artists, can be creators, can be in leadership mm-hmm. positions, can be curators. And I think I think more of that obviously needs to happen. We need to go much farther down yeah, that road. Yeah.
Well, and it's especially, you know, I think it would be in bad taste to not kind of, you know, drag publishers that fetishize books and will not release, you know, or publish anything, an ebook or audiobook or any of that sort of thing. Or it's only in that case, it's only accessible if you are in an academic, you know, institution, if you're in school and that sort of thing. So it's like, you know, a publisher is like, oh, it's not a book, I can't hold it, I can't go on a shelf, I can't show it off, then it's not a real thing. It's like, it's still a book, man. You know, ebooks are accessible books, as my friend Leona Godin says all the time. She's a publisher and she's had to deal with that kind of stuff too. Like, well, why are we going to include this digitally? You know, can't go to a bookstore. And so that's what's wonderful about, you know, the McSweeney's thing, is that they're taking this, you know, they're just kind of like, hey, we can do this and it's fun. And you know, the issue itself is like a box full of stuff. It's got all kinds of stuff, and my thing is presented in a little dossier. You know, you've got that, but then you also have it just in such ridiculous depth, you know, for the online version, where, you know, everything is described and accessible, and like the whole thing, it's this accessibility initiative, by this, you know, I don't know, I don't want to necessarily call them absurdist or satirical, but you know, this wonderful world of fiction and not, you know, an academic or educational resource in which you would expect that to be. It's like, hey, you know, here comes a bunch of merry pranksters to wave it in your face. And so the idea that you know, JSTOR is going to have this issue available in their catalog is like, I don't know, I think it's wonderful. And I look forward to seeing how in the world they're going to archive that, especially the audio stuff.
Cool. Well, anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up?
What's that? I'm sorry.
Oh, anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up?
No, I just want to thank you and everybody for listening to me ramble.
Yeah, no, it was fun to chat, and excited to hang out and looking forward to future hangouts.
Yeah.
Okay.